Hello, and welcome to the Hill to Hill podcast. Today, we're talking with Alana Stide of the Smithsonian, who studies the history of technology and the history of computing. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Great. So tell us a little bit about your background and what you do at the Smithsonian.
Sure. So I call myself a historian of technology, but my title at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History is Curator of the History of Computers and Information Sciences. I know it's a mouthful, but I'm the keeper of the computing collection in our museum. So I collect and interpret and study the objects related to and material culture related to the history of computing, but conceived pretty broadly.
Great, thank you.
Can you tell us more about your educational background?
Sure. So most recently, I got a PhD in 2018 from Cornell University, my Department of Science and Technology Studies. So I finished my dissertation and then soon after joined the team at the Smithsonian. Before that, I was working in a few different museums, mostly in the Mid-Atlantic region. I also have a master's in history and museum studies from the University of Delaware. I am also a Cornell undergrad, class of 2006. So at Cornell, I majored in, well, the department at the time was called Textiles and Apparel. Now it's called Fiber Science and Apparel Design.
What does a day in the life look like as a curator at the Smithsonian?
What I love about being a curator is that every day is different. So yes, there's a lot of emailing here and there, but there's also all different kinds of meetings that I participate in. So there are meetings around, exhibition planning, collections management meetings, meetings within my division, which is the Division of Medicine and Science. So, planning for things that are coming up, whether there might be visitors that are coming that we need to schedule tours for, those sorts of things. A lot of my day sometimes is spent doing different kinds of research projects, and they're not all based on my own specific research agenda. So what I will say is one thing that curators can do and are encouraged to do at the Smithsonian is work on their own research projects. So that's part of what I do. My area of interest is the history of computer graphics and animation. But a lot of the other research that I do pertains to things that come in, so inquiries that come in that are related to objects in our collection. So I'm expected as, the steward for the computing collection, which is part of our national collection, to be able to respond, to say something back based on the inquiry that comes my way. I also do research around, because part of my job is collecting objects and cultivating the collection, I need to make sure that I know about the histories of the things that are on offer. So aside from wanting to learn about the history of, for instance, a particular object and its use, also knowing about its historical context, knowing about where it came from, the different kinds of life cycles that it might have had, and then, of course, whether or not that specific object on offer would be appropriate for our collection to begin with. And that in itself takes another set of conversations and kind of things I need to think through. And it's all fun stuff, and I'm happy to be there.
So what kinds of challenges do you face in your field or in your role?
I'll talk about challenges in my role. What I will say is I'm a fairly new curator there. So I've been there for, at this point, less than a year. So I am told, by the way, the Smithsonian is a big mammoth entity, and even the American History Museum is quite large too. There's a lot of curators and collection managers and educators, docents, volunteers, all kinds of people that I might interact with in any given day. It is a very steep learning curve. I am told that it takes like a good 2 years to actually like get your bearing and know what it is that you're meant to do. I do think that there are some certain things that I'm doing at this point that, you know, kind of feel like autopilot and that feels good. But in terms of challenges to that, you know, we're the museum has a finite amount of space, and a major draw for bringing in groundbreaking scholarship, but also making sure that our collections and the way that we interpret them and tell stories about them continue to be relevant for a contemporary audience involve needing to basically negotiate for space. So what's wonderful about that is, of course, there are, you know, physical exhibitions, and we can choose to work on, for instance, curating and researching around exhibitions and working in physical exhibition spaces. We are more and more trying to take advantage of certain digital initiatives. So, you know, when it comes to specifically exhibitions, we can also choose to stage an online exhibition or make our objects accessible to members of the public or researchers from any corner of the world who might have access to the internet to study our objects and study different facets of, you know, what it is that professionals at the Smithsonian might have to say about those objects. So the competing for space thing is one way around that, is to really kind of take advantage of certain other kinds of alternative ways in which to, for lack of better phrasing, get your voice out there. If you want to tell stories about objects and American history, you've got to find a way to do it.
I'm wondering if you have a favorite artifact, and if so, what is it?
This is such a tough question. Because I'm here with all of you, and because I care very much about this podcast, I will answer it with a specific object. But know that I care very much about all the objects, not just in the collection that I'm the keeper of, but throughout the museum and throughout the Smithsonian and lots of other places too. I've been thinking about, and my heart has been set on, a really funny little instrument called a light gun. And it came from, it's from a computer that was pretty one of a kind and pretty groundbreaking for its time, made at MIT. The computer's called the Whirlwind. So it was developed between the late 1940s and early 1950s. But the light gun is a peripheral, kind of a component of it, that is a light-sensing pointing device. So think about point-and-click these days, or think about, you know, the ways in which you might interface with your computing device. This actually looked like a little gun. It was metallic. It was connected to some funny little tubes that connected to the rest of the mainframe computer, which was quite large. This light gun would interact with the screen that the operator would then, you know, kind of interface through to be able to talk to the computer. The Whirlwind in itself is a very early example of real-time interactivity when it comes to digital electronic computing. So if you think about it, at that time, and especially in the late 1940s, real-time components of working with computers was kind of unheard of. So input-output took time. You would feed information into the computer, and then you'd wait a while, and then get output, get results. Usually some form of scientific calculations were involved. But this was a little bit different, because this involved real-time output, and it was mainly involved in various kind of aircraft defense and radar efforts.
Yeah, so kind of going off of that question, what would you consider is one of the most valuable items within your purview? So I guess, what do you think is the most valuable?
This is a very difficult question to answer, and actually, I will say, it would be a conflict of interest, first of all, to talk in very specific ways and in terms of numbers about valuation of objects. Of course, certain values need to be associated with objects for insurance purposes, because also, you know, we might be embarking on a loan agreement or some sort of way in which, or even just protecting the object to begin with, like, God forbid there's some sort of fire or disaster or something. I would never want that to happen, but we would need to figure out ways to assign some sort of value to all of our priceless treasures in the collection. I will say that within the computing collection, we're very blessed to have many one-of-a-kind examples from the history of early computing. So I'm not even sure, in my job presently, I've not been asked to put a value on objects like that. There might be a time in the future where I will have to do that. Note how I'm really trying to answer your question, but it's difficult too. So think national treasure, think one of a kind, think things that you can't get on eBay, things that don't exist in other museums, right? Those are the most priceless. And if you think about priceless works of art, right, think about it very similarly, but in terms of hunks of metal.
All right, so given that your research specialties kind of include research in technology and computing, how would you say that studying the overall history of technology ultimately feeds into your understanding of technology today?
Understanding the history of technologies, broadly conceived, so all kinds of technologies, whether or not they're electronic computing devices or what, manufactured items where, you know, there's some sort of kind of design rationale to the process, or, you know, things in use. To think about the lived experiences of these objects and change over time feeds into the way in which we understand social relations. The way in which we make sense of not just things around us in the world and how that has changed over time, but the way in which people interact with each other and those things in the world, the good and the bad, and everything in between, even the mundane. So to use stories from the past and to think through a history of technology lens, and through, by the way, thinking about the history of technology, we can also fan out and think about legal implications, implications for aesthetics, implications for, you know, politics, implications for popular culture when it comes to technology. It touches on so many different things, and that's why, again, I'm an advocate for history of technology and thinking historically about technology very broadly, because it will inform the way in which we come to interact with things in the world, the way we treat our planet, the way we choose to consume, and then also the way in which we choose to communicate with each other.
Alana, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This has been the Hill to Hill podcast, examining one issue at a time. Thank you for listening.